We present For One Horrible Moment by Peter Bradshaw. Episode 5. Redemption.
Previously on For One Horrible Moment. As a young boy growing up in the Fens, I have formed a sexual fascination with a local older girl called Susan, who bears a striking resemblance to me. In defiance of my family's warning to stay away from her, we have lain together and consummated our passion. Now, on the eve of my 13th birthday, my father has promised to reveal the truth about Susan at last.
Midnight and my 13th birthday are heralded by the chiming grandfather clock as we finish supper. With an elegantly tapered sterling silver coffee spoon, Father taps the crystal goblet from which he has been drinking a 49 Longueville and calls, quite redundantly, for silence. My brother Edward, my faithful terrier Jif Moose, and I look at him warily as from the darkness our maid Gretchen wheels out a hostess trolley, bearing a giant cake.
This was the cue for a tradition of which Papa was particularly fond. At family birthdays, the number of candles on the cake would be based not on how many years one had lived, but on how many more years Papa expected one to survive. My great-aunt Edith was deeply discomposed at her 77th birthday, when Papa presented her with a cake with 1.5 candles on it. So, having taken into account our family's history of strokes and prostate cancer, Papa made me blow out 41 black candles.
It is time for presents, which are in a little mound next to the cake. 200 Embassy Regal cigarettes from Edward, a painting by numbers book of minor members of the royal family from Mama, and from Father, a large box of his own construction, with a crank handle at the side and a funnel at the top. This he describes as a recycling device for converting human waste into furniture. But there is one more present, a long-playing record which I see is a Decca label cover version of Jimi Hendrix's Electric Ladyland, as recorded by the Mike Sam Singers. "Who is this present from, Papa?" I ask plaintively. Grimly, Papa rings a small bell, and a person steps through from a side door, flanked by a uniformed woman police constable, and a lady who I subsequently find out is Mrs. Beasley, senior caseworker at the South Cambridgeshire Social Services Unit. The person steps out of the shadows as far as she can, given that she is handcuffed to the policewoman. It is Susan. Involuntarily, I move to embrace her, but she shrinks back, and Papa simultaneously stops me.
"Son," he says, "this present is from Susan. The local authorities have allowed her this one last contact with you before she is taken away."
I turn towards Susan, but she remains impassive, and again I am dumbstruck by the tight pirate curls, the snub nose, everything that looks like me. "But Papa, why?" I ask. "What has Susan done?" Papa is silent for a moment, and then asks how old I think Susan is. I stammer, "Why, 16? 17?
"Look closer," Father says.
I step up to Susan, and for the first time I see the dryness and slight slackness of her skin, the hint of crow's feet around her eyes, and the touch of grey in her hair.
"Susan is 31.
Says Papa.
"And she is your mother."
Slowly, my father explained how he had been longing for a second son after Edward was born, but Mama insisted she found the whole business of childbirth, and indeed sexual intercourse with him, too traumatic. Eventually my father was compelled, reluctantly he insisted, to father a child with Susan, our maid, later our au pair, and my vivid memories of being born were of being born to Susan. This eventually provoked Mama's psychological crisis that I dimly remembered at Hunstanton Beach. So Susan had to leave, and only now returned to haunt our family, obsessed with seeing her child again, an obsession that overbalanced into forbidden longing. The phrase, "you'll laugh about this some day," is used, I find, indiscriminately. Had anyone in the room chaffingly used it to me then, I think I might have howled in existential anguish and put my eyes out before staking myself to the exposed hillside, assuming, that is, that I was in a position to find my way outside. In fact, I was able to laugh about it, indeed to guffaw most unbecomingly in a public place, when Edward, father, and I went 20 years later for our final, ill-fated trip to London last February. The three of us are lunching at Wilton's in Jermyn Street. Papa is now an old man, and Eddie and I are in early middle age. They have opted for the game special, pheasant, grouse and partridge, served up on a bed of lead shot. I have ordered the more ascetic salmon fish cakes. The conversation moves, as it so often does, to Ernest Jones's Freudian interpretation of Hamlet, which Edward is reading in preparation for his admission as Fellow of All Souls, Oxford. He remarks that he finds Freud's theory of the ubiquity of the Oedipus complex unconvincing. Papa does not agree. The discussion becomes heated. Finally, Edward exclaims, "Well, I should know. I've studied Freud's interpretation of dreams in the original German." Papa rejoins, "Well, I should know better than you. I've read Sophocles' Oedipus in the original Greek." I burst in, "Well, I should know better than both of you. I've actually done it with my mother." There is dead silence for some moments, and then I laugh heartily, and then Papa and Eddie join in, and then the whole restaurant, and it really is the most marvellous release of tension after those uncomfortable years keeping shtum about my unorthodox sexual debut. Over pudding and digestif, Papa relaxed and told me a little more about Susan. After serving 3 months in a minimum security prison in Madingley, Susan had gone back to live in the white cottage in the middle of the copse near March that she had taken me to that distant, idyllic summer with her strange foster brother Olaf. We amble out into the Jermyn Street sunshine in a rich and expansive mood. At the end of the afternoon, before we can embark on our return journey into the bleak, featureless wasteland of the Fen, we take an underground train round from Westminster to Liverpool Street on the Circle Line. And just as we are about to take the ascending escalator onto the station concourse, poor Papa gets it into his head to run up the descending escalator, the way that contestants do on Gladiators, one of his favourite programmes.
"It's all about commitment," he shouts.
At the very crest of the escalator he slows, his legs pounding, apparently unable to make any more headway. With a final lunge, he flings himself forward and clings with his fingertips on the ridge at the top as the escalator bumpily tries to pull him by his feet back down. Edward and I know better than to try to help him and just watch as he heaves and scrambles his way out. He stands up, swaying dangerously and raving about his personal best at the Travelator event. One rail track official and two British Transport police officers are coming towards us, but Papa has not seen them. He marches over to the Casey Jones outlet, in which stunned customers part before him like the Red Sea before Moses. He stops for a rest, sags to his knees, and then rolls over onto his side. We all reach him at the same time.
"Son," he slurs into my ear, "I should like you to see Susan again."
Before concluding enigmatically,
"We are a grandfather,"
and dying of a massive aneurysm. Papa's funeral was a deeply upsetting affair for us all, largely because of the specific instructions that he had left. Edward and I were to carry the coffin, which was made of lead, in order to be especially heavy. Some of the village came to the service, held in our own multi-denominational chapel, and quite a lot of people from the South of England chapter of Jews for Jesus. But they were affronted by the reading, which Papa had specified be given by Freddy Parrotface Davis. Mr. Davis read the solemn words with a large bowler hat pulled down low over his ears, and every time he reached a sibilant, he would pronounce it by making a loud farting noise with his tongue. The moment he was finished, he shouted, "Aye, aye!" pulled a lever, and Papa's coffin moved backwards on a conveyor belt towards the crematorium that he had made Mr. Gerald, the gardener, construct in the last years of his life. A sombre organist played an aria based on Bach's Mass in B minor, which Mr. Davis accompanied on the spoons. Then Mr. Davis came over to Mama and demanded his fee, which he said was £750 plus VAT. The conversation grew animated, with Mother insisting she would not pay him, as his face did not sufficiently resemble a parrot. The resulting affray between Freddy Parrot-Faced Davis and certain members of the congregation had its sequel in the local county court. An unfortunate, but perhaps not entirely inappropriate note for my father's life to end on. It is only 3 weeks after the funeral that I feel able to visit Susan in the white cottage. I knock hesitantly on the heavy oak door, flaking and splintering with age and wet rot. Olaf answers it, now extremely bowed with age and resentful of all visitors, though he perks up when I give him 2 live ducks as a present. He retreats to the kitchen, calling for Susan in his harsh Fenland dialect, and presently she comes down the narrow winding stair and meets me in the mean little parlour. Her hair is grey now, and her face plump. She asks me if I would like a cup of tea. I say I would like that very much. We sit in silence for some moments. Finally, I gulp and ask her what Papa can have meant when he said something about being a grandfather. Susan stirs uneasily. She has clearly been expecting the question. It is soon answered for her when the door crashes open and I hear the sound of a young man's voice shouting something about being home. Susan cannot prevent this young man, at once my son and half-brother, walking into the parlour and meeting me for the first time. Nor does she. It is a revelation. The young man, whom Susan has named Steve, is a fine young specimen, 6'2" tall, with the dark gypsy curls and snub nose that are now so firmly entrenched in the family's gene pool. But there is something else there as well, a blueness in the eyes, a fine, strong manliness in his whole aspect. Steve is in his 3rd year at Trinity, Cambridge, where his work in classics and philosophy has been deemed brilliant enough to be offered a fellowship. He is an Olympic-class athlete who has performed superbly in the Atlanta Games of 1996. His abstracts in oil and bits of toilet paper have been bought by Charles Saatchi, and as a pianist, he has just recorded the later Beethoven piano concertos with the Los Angeles Philharmonic. The combined effect is so dazzling that it is all I can do to stop myself enfolding Steve in my arms, raising my face to the heavens, and weeping with unfettered joy. As it was, I passed a pleasant evening with Steve and Susan. We had a simple meal with Tolly Cobbold Ale, and later we walked outside and watched the sunset against the massive prairie sweep, and as my eye travelled along the level plain, whose far limit undulated briefly over the silhouette of Ely Cathedral, I fancied for one marvellous moment that Papa was standing next to us. How happy he would have been to be with us all, his extended family, at the day's languorous end, watching the sun bleed slowly into the islanded horizon of the fen.
For One Horrible Moment was written and narrated by Peter Bradshaw. The producer was John Naismith.
And that was the final part of For One Horrible Moment. If you've missed any previous episodes, you can find them all on BBC Sounds. Next week at this time, the Empire's favourite weekly is back on the shelves. Susie Brown, Alistair McGowan and gang bring us nostalgia galore with Boys Own style adventure spoof The Harpoon. That's next Tuesday night at 11.
The new series of The Digital Human on BBC Radio 4.
There's something about conspiracy theorists that I have found. They cannot shut up.
Charting the impact of technology on our daily lives.
The content, the ideas, the memes, the images, the videos.
Let's get a map of the system.
Where do people go when they've been banned from online spaces?
their potential to wreak havoc still remains present.
And when we represent real life digitally, is there a collapse in our sense of context? The Digital Human with me, Alex Kratosky, on BBC Radio 4. Now available on BBC Sounds.
Hello, listeners of the radio.
This is the Comedy Club.
Love. On BBC Radio 4 Extra.
This will be a place of calm and tranquility.
Next tonight, we listen in on an eventful road trip in Friends Like These.